Welcome to NGA Notable Lectures, a podcast offering a deeper understanding of all things artistic. The year 2019 marks the 50th anniversary of the Apollo 11 moon landing on July 20, 1969. Photography played a significant role both in preparing for the mission and in shaping the cultural consciousness of the event. By the Light of the Silvery Moon, A Century of Lunar Photographs features works ranging in date from the 19th century to the Space Age 1960s. The event, Photographing the Moon, held on October 3, 2019 at the National Gallery of Art, celebrated this exhibition by inviting three curators from the Smithsonian Institution's National Air and Space Museum to give talks on the intertwined histories of photography and space exploration. In the second lecture, Matthew Schindel described the development and impact of the field of photogeology, which provided early photography of the Earth and Moon from airplanes and eventually allowed for mapping and selecting landing sites for human missions to the Moon.
Okay, so you've now seen the Moon through telescopes. Now we're going to look at the Moon through the photography that was done by the robotic orbiters and landers that were sent to the Moon prior to the Apollo program. When I talk about lunar photography and when I talk about especially planetary and lunar geology, I usually like to start by talking about Tim Much. He was essentially the author of the first textbook of planetary geology, and this was it, Geology of the Moon, a Stratigraphic View. And Much was a stratigrapher. He was a professor of geology at Brown University. And in 1967, he decided that what was going on with the Moon was really very interesting. It was more interesting than any questions that he had about the Earth. And so he decided that he was going to take a sabbatical and go off to the newly founded astrogeology branch of the USGS, spend some time with the geologists there. And from that experience, and also from the frustration that he felt that a lot of the images that they were using that had been taken by spacecraft weren't available to most geologists who are out in the academic community, he decided that he wanted to publish a book that would sort of capture those images and collect them together, and then also develop a method of using those images that other geologists could use. So he decided he was going to write this book, and because of his own biases as a stratigrapher, it was going to basically be a stratigraphic approach to looking at the Moon. And I like to show the first pages of the book because his choice of image for the frontispiece, I think, is very telling. Ansel Adams' Autumn Moon, the High Sierra from Glacier Point. It was taken in Yosemite National Park during Adams' time there at Yosemite. I think the visual argument that Much was making here is really very literal. It is that the Moon is an extension of terrestrial terrain, that it could be studied as though it's an extension of terrestrial terrain with the same methods that geologists had perfected over the years of studying the Earth and studying the history of the Earth through what was visible in its terrain. One of the notes that Much makes here is that we've basically entered a new era of spacecraft photography of the Moon. He says, the sudden surge in photographic information following the success of three impacting spacecraft, the Rangers, five soft landing spacecraft, the Surveyors, five orbiting satellites, the Orbiters, and several manned orbiting and landed spacecraft, the Apollos, and various Russian spacecraft, the Zonds and the Lunas, is truly unprecedented. Almost the entire Moon has been photographed with a resolution of 100 meters or better, and overlapping photographs provide stereoscopic coverage for many areas. So basically he's saying, it's there. The data is there. We can now do the geology of the Moon because we know essentially we have 99% of the Moon available to us through these photographs. And so the photographs he's referring to are ones that started to come back in the late 50s as a result of the space race. So the first was October 7th, 1959. This is the first image ever of the far side of the Moon that was sent back by the Soviet Union's Luna 3 spacecraft. You don't see that much detail in this photo, but still, it was enough to reveal that the far side was not quite as visually interesting, I suppose, as the near side of the Moon. Then in 1964, July 31st, the first U.S. spacecraft image of the lunar surface. This was the Ranger 7 spacecraft. And you might wonder why the first U.S. image is from a Ranger with the number 7 and not the number 1. And it's because there were basically a number of failures on the way to Ranger 7 that meant that it wasn't until the 7th mission that they ended up with lunar photography. So Ranger 7 was an impacting mission. It crashed into the moon. That it was actually designed to do that. And three times it did it correctly with 7, 8, and 9. In the case of Ranger 7, it actually returned over 4,300 images before crashing into an area that they later named Mare Cognitum, which basically means the sea that has become known, because it had now been photographed in high detail by Ranger 7. You might wonder how, within a matter of, you know, we're talking about 17 to 20-some minutes of descent, how it was able to capture that many images at once. And if you look, there you see me with my twin, the conservator David, as we were working on cleaning our Ranger spacecraft. And when we were cleaning our Ranger, which is essentially an engineering model that was used for testing some of the systems on the Ranger spacecraft, so it never went into space, but it's been hanging at the Air and Space Museum for many years, I think pretty much since the museum opened or shortly thereafter. You can see in the image on the right, when we took off the metal skin of the spacecraft, what we saw in there were 6 Bausch & Lomb lenses, and those lenses are connected to a television camera system designed specially for this mission by RCA. And so those 6 cameras were all essentially pre-programmed to take a series of images as it was descending. So those 6 cameras were all working, you know, nonstop, full-time on the way down to the moon. And so by the time it got to the surface, it took an incredibly high detail image of you know, one very small part of the moon. But as you can imagine, when it first started, you're getting larger and larger swaths of the moon. Then in 1965, more images of the far side of the moon, courtesy of the Russians. This was the Zond 3 spacecraft. And this time you're able to see a little bit more detail than you were with the Zond 1. You're starting to see more craters, although it's still not quite as cratered as the near side of the moon. And then the first soft landing on the moon, the Luna 9, also a Soviet mission. You can kind of get the sense that Americans were feeling that the Russians were doing very well with the moon. and maybe we were floundering a bit at this point. But nonetheless, the world pretty much celebrated this high detail image of the moon. Even the Americans who were watching, I think, watched with a little bit of professional jealousy, at least on the part of the geologists. But then in 1966, we landed our first soft lander on the moon, and this was the Surveyor 1 spacecraft. And with Surveyor 1 and the surveyors that followed, we were able to get imagery of the moon that was essentially what you would see if you were standing on the moon looking at the horizon, because the height of the camera on the Surveyor spacecraft was basically the height of the human eye. So if you mosaicked enough of the images, the high detail, high resolution images that were captured by this camera system, you could begin to piece together very high resolution mosaics of what the lunar surface looked like and what it might look like to an Apollo astronaut if they were walking out at a particular landing site. So as you can imagine, these were sent to areas that were thought to be potentially good landing sites for Apollo. Well, one of the complaints that the geologists had about these images was that even though you get great detail from these, it's very difficult to tell distances and scale, so they're not actually geologically that valuable, except for those images that were taken when it was pointed straight at the ground, and where you could see the actual grain size of the lunar soil, and then some of the Surveyor spacecraft actually had scoop arms that were able to dig trenches and determine the mechanical properties of the soil, and they also had a chemistry experiment, essentially, that was able to tell what the composition of the lunar soil was and determined that it was a lot like the volcanic basalt that we have here on Earth. So these missions gave us our first real idea or understanding of what the moon might be like as a landing site and what we need to take into account for a spacecraft that would be landing there. But the first really systematic program to photograph the moon in its entirety was the Lunar Orbiter program that ran from 66 to 67. I have a typo there in the slide. But this was five orbiting spacecraft, each of which carried a dual lens camera system that was able to I'm going to show you a photo of the camera in a minute, so you'll get a sense of it. But it was able to take photos in medium resolution and high resolution at the same time. It had a wide angle and a narrow angle lens on the camera system. And that camera system was actually designed by Eastman Kodak, and it was derived from designs that had been developed by the National Reconnaissance Office for the U-2 and the SR-71 spy planes. So this was a spy camera that had been adapted to a lunar camera. And altogether, they returned 2,180 high-resolution and 882 medium-resolution frames from the moon and mapped about 99% of the lunar surface. And I say there with a resolution of 100 meters or better, the better is pretty impressive. The highest resolution that they got was 1 meter resolution when the spacecraft were closest to the moon. So this is the Lunar Orbiter when it was being prepared. You know, some last minute. I actually think this is probably NASA put the caption on this image. It was an official NASA image that says this is being prepared for flight, but I don't think so. I think this is actually a engineering model that they took a picture of, because usually you don't just have a guy in sleeves rolled up making adjustments to a spacecraft. Even back then, they were a little more careful than that. But you can see how they've got the delicate gloves and hairnets on when they're treating the camera system itself. That gives you an idea of what the camera system actually looked like when it was not inside of the spacecraft bus. It's really an impressive machine. If you look at a schematic of how it actually works, all of the spacecraft I showed you before used television cameras to record images and send them back to Earth, and it's a relatively easy system to use because television signals are easy to transmit, they're easy to collect and translate back on Earth. We have that technology, right? Television is something that by then was in wide use. But spy satellite cameras, spy plane cameras used film. And the only way really to get good high-resolution images that would be useful in selecting landing sites from orbit was to continue using film in that way. So how do you have a film camera and return images to Earth? Well, they developed a method that was able to develop the negatives on the spacecraft and then run those negatives through, you see there the line scan tube, which is pointing, so this is pointing a beam of light at the negative as the negative is going through the system. And then this photo multiplier tube is collecting the light and translating it into a video signal, and then that video signal is being sent back to Earth. It's being recorded on magnetic tape back on Earth, and it's also being transferred to 35 millimeter film back on Earth. So it's a very complicated sort of Rube Goldberg apparatus of how to take a photo on film and then get that image processed and developed and sent back to Earth without ever having to collect the film, which is what you would have had to do with a spy satellite or spy plane, where the film canisters, in the case of the satellites, were dropped and then collected. But when you're on the moon, there's no one to collect it, at least not yet, right? So Lunar Orbiter, the first Lunar Orbiter, was partially successful. The wide-angle camera worked very well. The narrow-angle high-res camera was smudged somehow. So it was a little bit of a disappointment, and it never quite made the front page, the successes of the first Lunar Orbiter. It was always, you know, below the fold or in the internal section of the newspaper, even though it did get written up in the New York Times. But it also, though, produced some pretty incredible imagery. This, for example, is the first good image of the Earth photographed from the vicinity of the moon, and this was a Lunar Orbiter 1 image. So we like to think about the Apollo 8 image of Earthrise as being the first image of the Earth from the moon. And it is the first image that a human took of Earth from the moon, but a robot got there first and returned this image. So when Lunar Orbiter 2 actually did work completely, both the high-res and the medium-res camera, It was front page news. So for the Boston Globe, this is actually a picture. David showed you multiple pictures of Copernicus Crater. This is Copernicus Crater from an oblique angle, and having been photographed by the high-res camera from Lunar Orbiter 2, and it was impressive, right? You can see the peaks in the center of that crater with more detail than anyone had ever seen before, and you can see here off to the side, the Globe has sort of used a quote here, featured a quote, "It's almost as though a photographer actually stood inside the crater to take these shots." So folks were pretty impressed. It also made the front page of the New York Times, so they didn't call it the photo of a century, the Boston Globe did. And you see that, though, quoted all the time. So the New York Times, because maybe they were avoiding hyperbole, doesn't get to be the paper that gets quoted on that image. Boston Globe gets it. So here, that image was taken November 23rd, 1966. The way that the camera system worked was it took the two images simultaneously. Both lenses were always used simultaneously. So you would always get the wide angle and narrow angle shot at the same time. So there you see Copernicus Crater appear on the ridge, and here you see the close-up image of the interior of Copernicus Crater. And if you took a lot of these, especially the wide-angle images, and mosaic them together, you could start to map the moon in lunar orbiter imagery. And this is what they did throughout the lunar orbiter program. From lunar orbiter 1 to 5, they built mosaics of the lunar surface, and this is the way that they started thinking about good landing sites. In addition to the surveyor imagery, these were the images that were used to get a global view of what the different terrains of the moon looked like. And it was orbiters 1 through 3 that were the ones that were there mainly for Apollo landing sites. So they had equatorial orbits. So they orbited around the equator of the moon and were looking for safe landing sites, or the imagery was being used to look for safe landing sites in that equatorial region. That was considered to be the safest spot for landing. By the time Lunar Orbiter 3 was done with its mission, they had accomplished that goal. So Lunar Orbiters 4 and 5 were put into polar orbits and were able to complete that mapping of the moon. And from the scientists' perspective, see some things that were more interesting than the equatorial regions, because nobody had ever gotten a really good look at the poles of the moon. And this mission allowed them to do that. So what do you do with those images once you get them? I mentioned earlier that Tim Mutch had gone off to spend time at the USGS Astrogeology Branch. So the Astrogeology Branch had been founded by Eugene Shoemaker, who you may know his name from other space exploits. For example, there was the Shoemaker-Levy comet that crashed into Jupiter back in, what year was that? 94. So, you know, he was a very active scientist in the planetary science community, and he really pushed the USGS to become involved in lunar research. And the fact that the USGS already had a mapping division built into it meant that when it came time for the government to make decisions about NASA funding, and NASA said they wanted their own mapping division, the government said, well, the USGS already does that. Go to them. And so Eugene Shoemaker was able to take advantage of that. And he, back in the 1950s, before any of this photography had even been taken yet, had foreseen that this would be a possibility and had written up his own proposal for how to do stratigraphy of the moon, mainly using telescopic photos at that point. So it was a natural fit for him to push USGS towards doing photogeology of the moon. And then you have characters also like Farouk Elbaz, who became the secretary of the Lunar Landing Site Selection Committee within NASA via his position at Bellcom, a company that was providing engineering support for the Apollo missions. And Farouk Elbaz eventually became the head or the founder of our Center for Earth and Planetary Studies at the National Air and Space Museum. But at the time of Apollo, he was a pretty young geologist and managed to sort of work his way into a position of quite a bit of authority there at NASA, you know, determining from those photographs using photogeology techniques what the landing site should be. And the tools of the photogeologists are pretty simple. They are stereoscopes, a lot like those original stereoscopes that David talked about that were used primarily for entertainment. the USGS had developed methods, and this wasn't unique to them. Army Corps of Engineers had also developed similar methods, and the two had sort of shared their understandings and technologies. But using aerial photography, stereoscopic aerial photography, they would create geologic maps and also extract geologic information from photography using stereographs and sort of sitting very studiously like this over a table, looking through the stereoscope at the images and drawing by hand while looking at the stereoscope. It's a technique that I think probably takes a lot of practice. And so when Thomas Mutch wrote his textbook, which I introduced you to in the beginning of the talk, he said, well, you know, we almost got stereoscopic views of the moon, but it's not stereoscopic. Instead, what we have is opposite illumination. We have cases here where you have sunrise and sunset images of the same forms. So you can extract some of the same information that you would through stereoscopic viewing and through traditional photogeology. So here he's showing you Sinus iridum and noting how you can make out different aspects of it with different lighting. And together, if you put the information together, you have a much fuller view than you would get from just one photograph. And here he's talking about the same thing here with another landform. So it essentially took, through Mutch, through Shoemaker, and through Elbaz, and others like them, I could list off many other names, but these are three of the most central characters, turned the traditional techniques of photogeology of the Earth into a new field of orbital geology that could be applied to the moon and later to Mars when Mars exploration kicked off. And that tradition continues today. So you've seen so many images of Copernicus by now, but here's Copernicus again, as photographed by the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, a much more recent mission that's orbiting today around the moon and sending back images. You can see there's quite a lot of more detail there, and this isn't even the highest resolution version of Copernicus imagery from that mission. Take a look at those peaks, those central peaks, where you can actually see the grains in the lunar soil, and compare that to the picture of the century returned by Lunar Orbiter 2, right? We have definitely entered into a whole new world, and we now know the moon in much more detail thanks to these more recent photographic or imaging missions than we ever have before. So that's it. That's my story.
This has been a National Gallery of Art podcast.